We are recognizing and celebrating the works of Black composers and marking Juneteenth through music, the commemoration of ending of slavery in the U.S. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kend. This is Lift Every Voice and Sing. It's a hymn from 1900, often called the Black National Anthem. This version, arranged by William Grant Still, performed by Vidamus Ensemble, featuring baritone Robert Honeysucker. Join in on recognizing Black music composers and musicians, 800-642-1234. Lori Skelton is host of Afternoon Classics on the WPR News and Music Network and the All Classical Network from 1 to 3 weekdays, producer and host of Wisconsin Classical. Lori, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It is so good to be here, although I feel rather odd following that incredible voice singing. I'd rather just sit back and listen to music for the next half hour.
I agree. Can you reflect on that performance of Lift Every Voice and Sing?
Obviously, the voice is powerful, but this is an arrangement, and of course, you get a great song, and everybody wants it. William Grant Still is one of the founding fathers of Black classical music in America, and I love the arrangement we have here. It's a chamber ensemble, so a group of varying sizes can take part, and yet it has strings, and it has a piano, and it has winds, so you get everyone involved. And it's a marvelous way to bring music, classical music, into any situation. You don't always need a big symphony orchestra. Not that big symphony orchestras aren't wonderful, but so very often composers get their start or performers get their start working in smaller ensembles, and this is a great example of a small ensemble that just sounds so rich and powerful.
Lift Every Voice and Sing has such powerful meaning and undertones through history. Can you explain the cultural significance of this song?
Well, it was written at the turn of the 20th century. James Weldon Johnson wrote the words. His brother wrote the music. The first time it was performed, it was 500 school children in, Jacksonville, Florida, to celebrate Lincoln's birthday. And then in the 50s and 60s, it began to be sung more and more often as part of the civil rights movement. So it starts with young voices and grows. Lift every voice and sing. Every voice. I think that phrase does have power. The words are marvelous, but it is every voice. Mm. Every voice that becomes a part of a musical fabric that is continually being woven, being built, being created. Classical music, well, no music is static. Mm-hmm. Everything builds on what comes before. But what we think of as Western classical music definitely needs to look at the structures, the pieces that were written before you can go ahead and make your own unique contribution, something that grows the music as it goes forward.
I'm going to reintroduce you here, talking with Lori Skelton, host of Afternoon Classics on WPR's News and Music Network, as we talk about Black classical composers and musicians. Ahead of Juneteenth, you can join in with works that are on your mind, 800-642-1234. And Lori, of course, Juneteenth Sunday, we're going to hear some of the network selections in honor of the annual holiday. We just heard one there. But what connection do you draw between Juneteenth and classical music?
The idea that for European performers, violinists, composers, who were looking to learn about African music in the 18th and the 19th centuries, there wasn't the ethnomusicology studies in Africa that are being done today. And so many composers and performers were looking to America, looking to the music, the spirituals that came out of slavery, or the music that was being created by free black musicians in the northern part of America. People were looking to these compositions, these voices, these performances as to say what has a tie to America, and then, of course, what has been growing out of African melodies in American soil. When Antonin Dvorak came to New York in the 1890s to be head of our National Conservatory, here is a composer who had a deep love of the folk music of his homeland, and when he heard African-American spirituals being sung, he said, "It is in the Negro melodies of America I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music."
That's powerful.
So, I mean, this is at a time when American composers were only just starting to be educated in America. For a long time, if you were a musician in America, you were sent to Germany to study classical music. And Dvorak comes to America and says, no, you've got the roots right here. Pay attention to your music and grow from there.
Let's hear another selection, Wade in the Water, from 24 Negro Melodies by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. And this is performed by pianist David Schaefer Gottschalk. Could just go on and keep listening, Lori. And listening to the instrumental version is really beautiful, too, in the nuance there.
Because he's doing with Wade in the Water what European composers had been doing for centuries, taking a known melody and elaborating it, giving it a structure. The theme and variations that we hear in Brahms and composers going well into the 20th century. Take a melody that you know and show all of its possibilities. So it's not just a simple spiritual. He's showing us just how complex and gorgeous it is.
Samuel Coleridge Taylor has such an interesting background, too. And I'd love you to give a nod to, you know, his just the composer and the conductor and the political activist.
Well, here is someone who was raised in Britain. He was named for Samuel Taylor Coleridge. His mother was an Englishwoman. His father was from Sierra Leone. Here is someone who was fighting against racial prejudice all of his life, bringing African-American folk music in with concert music. He has pieces called The African Suite, African Romances, the 24 melodies that you mentioned. He would have heard the Fisk Jubilee Singers on tour in Europe in the 1890s. And here was music that he found incredibly powerful. He's probably best known to some in the Milwaukee area for the cantatas based on the poem The Song of Hiawatha. That's what made his name around the world. But I think it's with the pieces that he wrote featuring African melodies and African-American spirituals that I think have the real staying power in his canon.
We're just going to pause here for a moment and go out on Autochthonous, composed by William Grant Still. Lori Skelton, our guide, host and producer of Afternoon Classics, and we're exploring Black American composers and celebrating Juneteenth. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. This is Violin Concerto No. 1 in D Major, composed by Florence Price, performed by the Janáček Philharmonic, I think I said that right, Laurie Skelton, Janáček Philharmonic Orchestra. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're on a tour of Black composers and musicians who made their mark on the classical world, going unnoticed, unrecognized sometimes. Florence Price wrote more than 300 works, first African-American woman to achieve national acclaim for her compositions.
And she's going to have that violin concerto played this coming October. The Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra is including that work on that particular concert. There are a number of Wisconsin ensembles that have been bringing more Black composers, Black performers, composers of a number of incredible traditions are starting to show up more and more on the concert hall. So if you want to know where in Wisconsin you can hear this, get a dart and throw it at a map of the state. Or if your local ensemble hasn't yet found this, go ahead and ask them. Tell them you want to hear this.
I love her story, died in 53. Most of her works were unpublished, and many of her scores just went missing. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about her life?
She was, as you say, the first African-American woman to have her music performed by a major symphony. She was doing a lot of work in Chicago, which was having something very, very similar to the Harlem Renaissance going on in the early part of the 20th century. And music critics were calling her work faultless. Quote, a work that speaks its own message with restraint and yet passion, worthy of a place in the regular symphonic repertoire. They recognized that this wasn't just a novelty. This wasn't just, oh, aren't we wonderful? We're playing music by a Black woman. They're saying this is absolutely worthy to be up there on the stage with Mendelssohn, with Mahler. This needs to be heard. This needs to be a regular part of the listening experience, which is why those of us who program classical music at Wisconsin Public Radio have made a point of keeping this not just for Black History Month, not just for Juneteenth, although we're certainly happy to highlight it for those days. This needs to be a regular part of our programming, and it is more and more so. Even before COVID, I know Stephanie Elkins was working with our music librarian, Dennis Ryan, to make it easier to identify Black composers and Black performers in our database. So right today, we've got somebody on the Google Doodle, Amanda Aldridge, a British and African opera singer and composer who I did not know about. And so when I get off air with you today, I'm going to go learn more about her and see if we can get some of her music on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Let's listen to a bit more of Florence Price here. Can you talk about how the violinist is an advocate for her work?
We've got somebody, Erjine Kung. This is a recording that came out a few years ago that I know a lot of people paid attention to. And I gather it got Erjine a little bit of attention on his own account that this was... this was important enough that he needed to have this out there, whether or not this was actually part of his own background. I guess when you spend a lot of time with classical music, you tend to forget that there can be boundaries. You tend to forget that there can be, well, this is my music, or this was my heritage. You start thinking about it all as, I want to share this with everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly important, and can still move me to think, oh yeah, we've got to start crossing over and learning from one another.
Lori Skelton with us, who hosts Afternoon Classics on WPR's News and Music Network, as we talk about Black classical composers celebrating Juneteenth and some of the selections we're going to be hearing in classical music on the network in today and in coming days, and the efforts to bring more exposure to these composers. Join in at 800-642-1234. Lori, where do you want to go next? What should we listen to next?
There's what Norman is going to be playing at 11 o'clock today. Some of the 6 stanzas for string orchestra by Ulysses Kay would be a good one.
Perfect. Let's listen. Said that there's a tune in here we might recognize. I'm trying to pull it out.
Actually,
that's not it. Okay.
That's not Ulysses K. What you're listening to right now is something I've got on for this afternoon.
Ah.
This is something that was touring Europe in the 1830s, because this is from Francis Johnson. This is a short dance.
Yes.
I believe he was the first African-American composer to have works printed as sheet music.
Uh-huh.
Played violin, played keyed bugle. He was considered one of the leading military band leaders in the 1830s in Philadelphia. So bringing that to Europe, again, was having quite an impact on other ears. The 6 dances for orchestra that Ulysses Kay wrote includes, the first one has Skip to Malou in it.
Okay, and let's hear 6 dances in.
Okay.
That is so lovely. I love that, Lori.
Again, the idea of taking a simple melody and elaborating it. Mm-hmm. I've got to back up. I got my violinist mixed up. Erjin Khan is not he. She is a part of the Fort Smith Symphony, who has been doing so much to advocate for getting Florence Price's music recorded. So she's actually working with John Jeter, the conductor of that symphony, to get her music out there. I do apologize. I got my violinist mixed up, which is a lovely problem to have when you've got this many opportunities.
Yes.
Wisconsin ensembles have been playing as recently as last weekend. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra played a brand new work by Jesse Montgomery, and Madison Symphony, Lake Geneva Symphony, Duluth Superior Symphony, Milwaukee Symphony all have Black composers and performers on their concert schedules for next year. I'm waiting to hear from other ensembles around the state when we get ready for the brand new concert season.
Lori, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Lori Skelton, host of Afternoon Classics on WPR's News and Music Network. You can hear Classics by Request every Saturday morning at 10 on the network of Wisconsin Public Radio News and Music Network. If you have a favorite piece by an African-American composer or performer, fill out the online request form that's on the Music tab at WPR.org. Let's go out here, listen to some more music on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Father's Day is Sunday. Here is producer Steve Gotcher with a story from 2020 about the unique way he and his daughter have stayed in touch over the years.
When my daughter Erica was a little girl, she started a now 25-year tradition of sending me letters on pieces of birch bark. Last winter, we sat down and talked about how and why it began.
I remember having a book, and in the book there were all these wacky ideas, experiments, and things that kids could do. And one of the things was you could put a stamp on a banana and send it in the mail. I saw that and I wondered if it actually worked. And so I thought, what can I put through the mail? And I knew that you could write on birch bark and you could draw on it. So I thought, why not try a letter?
You have the first letter there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Why don't you read it to me?
Well, they all start the same, and they say, "Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. I am having a great time here, but I miss you a lot. Love you, Erica."
I think you were 5 or 6.
Yeah, well, I spelled writing R-I-T-I-N-G.
So when did you decide to do it again?
I don't remember. I think it's, I mean, I know why I do it now. I can't remember why I did it when I was younger. Now it's whenever I'm out in the woods and we're hiking and I see a piece of birch bark on the ground, I pick it up because it's a great fire starter, but also because I can write to you from wherever I am and it's a personal message.
Why don't you read the one you have right in front of you?
"Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. We are having a very fun time. I hope you the same, Erica." And then I have made a heart, a smiley face, and a swirly, which I believe was my signature at the time.
How old do you think you were then?
Probably 8.
And you are now 29,
mm-hmm.
So you've sent me a letter every year or so.
The spelling's gotten a little better. Handwriting is a little neater,
yeah.
Not much. You have to find the right piece of birch bark that can lie flat and can take the pen ink. Sometimes you have to scrape off a few layers of the birch bark, but that's neat because then you use that to start the fire and you write a letter on the rest of it.
And you sent some that actually have stamps on them.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read that one?
"Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. Although this won't send until I get back to the cities, I wanted you to know that I was thinking of you and Mama out here in the wilderness. Will you and Finn come back here with me someday? It is magical here. I love you, and I hope all is well. Love, Bun."
Do you recall many of the places you've sent them from?
Boundary Waters. Yeah, up in northern Wisconsin, I've done a lot of canoeing up there. I sent you one from Alaska. That birch bark wasn't from there because they don't have birch trees up in the Brooks Range of Alaska. So I brought it with Minnesota.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to tell you is that these letters mean a whole lot to me. As you can see, I've collected them and kept them safe over the years. And I never know when one is going to come in, but I always am delighted to see it.
Well, I'm not going to stop the tradition anytime soon. There's two I want to read.
Okay.
"Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. I love this tradition we have, and I hope we never stop doing it. I hope your summer is in full swing and filled with biking, grilling, outdoor music, and paddling. I can't wait to do some or all of those things with you when I visit in July. I love you, Papa, and I think about you whenever I find new music to love. You gave me that gift. Love, Bun." "Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. We are about to embark on our journey north, and I wanted to write and say thank you for all the adventures you took me on and for inspiring me to go on my own. Thank you. Happy Papa's Day. Love, Bun."
Thank you very much for sending me all those letters over the years. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to keep sending them, so.
Erica is a wilderness EMT and firefighter in Montana. Because of the pandemic, we've not seen each other since January. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, opioid overdose deaths have reached a record high in Wisconsin. What does the dangerous drug fentanyl have to do with fueling the epidemic? In collaboration with Wausau School District sixth graders, they pose their questions about this powerful synthetic opioid. Join in with your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Melinda Pauls is administrative captain for the Wausau Police Department. She is a drug recognition expert, provides law enforcement training around the state on the topic of drugs. Captain Pauls, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Before we dive into the sixth graders' questions, can you give us a better working knowledge of what fentanyl is?
Sure. So fentanyl is a narcotic medication. It is and it's still being used for opioid pain relief, for pain relief. It is an opioid. And what we're seeing nowadays, unfortunately, is other uses of it in mixing powders with heroin and other narcotics. So they're making them stronger and people are not used to that. And we are having a lot of overdoses because of that.
Well, let's get right into the first question. And it is a question from Elijah.
Why are people taking it if they know it is bad?
Why are they taking it if they know it's bad?
Well, so narcotic drugs are physically addicting. And some people become physically addicted and they just look for anything to help the symptoms of that addiction. So even though they know it's bad, their body physically has become used to having it in it. And they start to feel withdrawal symptoms, which are very, very flu-like ill symptoms. And they turn to something else to make those go away. And right now that something else many times contains fentanyl.
Do you know, Captain, how is fentanyl getting to Wisconsin? What are the paths into Wisconsin?
So most of it comes from overseas. We're seeing it being shipped through the mail. Many of what we're seeing and most of what we're seeing in our area is the powdered fentanyl. So that powder is then being mixed in with other drugs.
Okay. We heard from Kaylee, who wants to better understand what fentanyl looks like, and here is Kaylee's question.
How can you tell if the pill is real? What if it is in a box or a bottle?
Okay, so how can you tell if it's real? What if it's in a box or a bottle?
So generally, you should really only be using pills that come direct from a pharmacy. Any prescription pill will have a number or a letter or some type of marking on it. But unfortunately, what we're also seeing is some people are reproducing fake pills that look very, very similar to real ones. So unless you are getting it straight from a pharmacy, you may not know that it's not a real pill.
Joey of the school district asks, how much fentanyl can kill a person?
So that's kind of a tricky question because somebody who has been using a narcotic for quite a while sometimes will develop somewhat of a tolerance, so they're able to use a little bit more. However, somebody who's never used or never been around it and all of a sudden come in contact with it, they're going to have much less of a tolerance, so they're going to have the effects much quicker. As far as how much, even very, very small minutes of powder, little, you know, granules of sand, salt, very small quantities of concentrated fentanyl powder can kill somebody.
And what does it do once inside the body? Like what happens in our human system when fentanyl is released into it?
Sure. So fentanyl enters the body. The quickest way in the way that we're seeing most of the overdoses with powder especially is somebody breathing it in. So when you breathe something in, it goes right up to your brain and it attaches to receptors that control your respiratory system. And the way that fentanyl actually kills people is it slows down their respiratory system where they eventually stop breathing.
You know, we've been hearing about test strips. Can you test a drug for finding out if it is laced with fentanyl?
You can. And there are areas that are supplying fentanyl test strips that, along with like clean needles, that could be given out, and people can actually test their drugs to make sure it does not contain any fentanyl before using.
Melinda Pauls is with us, administrative captain of the Wausau Police Department, fielding questions on the dangerous drug fentanyl, one culprit of the soaring opioid deaths in our state. Join in on what you want to know about fentanyl, its role in the opioid epidemic. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Captain Pauls here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking a closer look at the dangerous drug fentanyl with help from Wausau sixth graders and their questions. According to our state health department, a dose of fentanyl is up to 50 times stronger than heroin and up to 100 times stronger than morphine. Join in on fentanyl and how the opioid crisis has affected you, affected a loved one. 800-642-1234. We have Administrative Captain Melinda Pauls of the Wausau Police Department, a 20-year veteran of the force, with us for about 9 more minutes. Captain Pauls, we heard from Marine in Milwaukee, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Marine wanted to add that doing hard drugs is a bad thing. And Marine has never done hard drugs, but has had a friend who did and wants to know how quickly can someone become addicted to fentanyl?
Well, with any narcotic, they can become very addictive. It really depends on the person. It's hard to say how quickly somebody can, but generally somebody who has an addiction and will talk about it will generally say that the first time they use that narcotic, it's a feeling that they're always trying to get back, and that's why they continue to use it.
This, I understand, might be a little bit out of your wheelhouse, but how is fentanyl addiction treated? What is that like?
So fentanyl, just like with all other narcotics, there's a lot of treatment options that we have available to people. They're long-term treatment programs. They are meant to slowly wean somebody off of a narcotic addiction. Some of those you may have heard of before, like Suboxone or methadone, are options that are out there. But unfortunately, narcotics are physically addicting, and they're very hard to wean somebody off of that addiction.
I would imagine relapse would also be a huge challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not uncommon when you talk to people that they tend to, you know, get on the right path, but it's not atypical to find somebody relapse up to 6-7 times before they really get that addiction curbed.
Last year, Wisconsin had more than 1,300 opioid overdose deaths, and that's the preliminary total from the state health department. What are you seeing in Wausau?
We are seeing those same statistics. It's gone up and up every year for the last 3 or 4 years. I think we already have 4 or 5 deaths this year contributing to overdoses.
What is your department's approach to trying to curb the crisis? What are you trying to do?
So one of the things that we are trying to do is hold people accountable that are selling the drugs. So we are going after the dealers. We also are trying different options with new treatment programs and getting people into treatment and getting them into the resources that they really need to curb that addiction.
Are you making inroads? What seems to be helping or working?
You know, I think it's an overall process. It's not just that we can fight one area. We have to look at the overall picture. So We have to look at the amount of drugs that are coming in, you know, dealing with the dealers, as well as taking that the need away as well. So it's really kind of a multi-area approach. I wish we had more resources available, honestly, for the amount of people that need the help.
You know, as a parent, as we hear these questions from sixth graders, what should we tell our kids? What should these conversations be like in school?
Well, I think we need to be honest with our kids. You know, they understand, they know, they hear things, and they're going to hear what they, or they're going to believe what they hear. So just being honest and understanding that these things are out there. They're physically addicting. You know, it's just because you think you may try something once doesn't mean that, you know, it's a fun thing to do with friends to try once. That one time may, you know, change and alter your life. So just understanding how drugs really affect you and what they can do long term, I think. Just being honest with our kids.
You do so much law enforcement training work, and I'm just wondering, what does training involve, especially to try to combat, you know, fentanyl and other dangerous drugs? What do officers need to know and really work on in skill building?
We do a lot of training. First of all, with officers, we talk about the effects that the drug causes on somebody. So recognizing that, being able to determine if somebody's impaired. If somebody is in driving while they're impaired, you know, that's a legal issue that we can talk about. But if it's not, and we can start getting them into the resources, you know, it's a start by just noticing what they're using and where we can help them. We also do a lot of training with other areas within the state. So we also do trainings like with teachers, and we go into the school and we talk to counselors and teachers and administrative staff to get them on board with recognizing early on maybe the symptoms of drug use. And if a student isn't impaired, and that way we can get them into resources early on where they don't get into that addiction phase.
Let's hear more from the sixth grade students. Here is Reggie wondering about how fentanyl affects the body.
If you sniffed a closed baggie of pills, can you die?
Okay, so if you sniffed a closed baggie of pills, what would happen?
Well, again, if you're not used to the drug, if your body has no tolerance and you breathe in any amount, you can become very sick. You can be overdosed. And obviously, you know, if you overdose, you may potentially die. So depending on what's in that, if there is something very, very concentrated like fentanyl in there, just sniffing and getting it into the air and getting into your body, yes, you can become affected.
What are the tactics that you use to reverse an overdose?
So with overdoses, especially when we're talking about narcotics, specifically fentanyl, it acts right on the respiratory system. So you can start giving rescue breaths because the person who's overdosing is going to stop breathing. The other option then is naloxone. There's nasal forms of naloxone. There's auto-injector forms, and then IV as well. So those are all options that we have within our city.
Talking about fentanyl, with student questions leading the way, we have the administrative captain for the Wausau Police Department, Melinda Pauls, with us, an expert on drugs. You can join in on fentanyl, the opioid crisis, and your experiences, 800-642-1234. McKenna has this question for you, Captain. She asks, why can't the government shut it down?
Unfortunately, the government doesn't have the resources to stop all of the trafficking that is coming through. A lot of this stuff is done through the mail, and we just don't have the resources, unfortunately, to go through every piece of mail that comes into the country. And again, this is mostly coming from overseas. So just with the amount of stuff that goes through the post office every day, there's things that are going to get through.
You had also talked about cracking down on dealers who are trying to sell it. How do you find those types of transactions? How do you find the dealers and track them down?
Well, many times it comes from talking with the individuals that are buying and overdosing and them recognizing the fact that they almost died and somebody else might almost die as well, and really just kind of working with them to figure out where it came from.
Miguel of the school districts is asking, why are people making this?
Well, unfortunately for some, it's a business and that's how they're making money.
How, here's student Amelia with a question about the history of fentanyl.
Okay.
Wasn't it first used for medicine? How?
Wasn't it first used for medicine? Can you give us a context of the medical background?
Sure. Fentanyl is still being used. It was and is still being used as medicine. It is a pain reliever. So it is given to somebody who has an injury or who maybe has some long-term chronic health issues that involve pain management. So it is still being used and it is being used in very good ways. But unfortunately, it's the ones that we see that are using it in other ways that we're having issues with.
I would imagine Amelia wants to know if it has such bad repercussions in abusing it, then why would prescriptions still be written for fentanyl? Aren't there other avenues?
Well, it's not the prescriptions that we're having issues with. The prescription fentanyl patients are using their fentanyl patches as prescribed. It's really the stuff that we're seeing from overseas that's coming on illegally that is then being used in more so drug use.
Would they be similar, the prescriptions versus what is coming overseas? Are they the same chemistry?
They are. They're the same drug. However, what we see being used medicinally are fentanyl patches.
Okay.
They're generally made to slowly absorb through the skin throughout the day to provide pain management. What we're seeing being used illegally is powdered fentanyl. So the powdered fentanyl is being brought over and then it's being mixed with illegal drugs like heroin. And that's where we're having the issues, especially with overdoses.
Captain Pauls, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
Melinda Pauls is administrative captain of the Wausau Police Department. A big shout out and thank you to the Wausau School District and PBS Wisconsin Education for collaborating. Students, you have fantastic questions. And if you're a teacher, would like to partner on a segment featuring student questions, get in touch with us. Email ideas at WPR.org. Just ahead, we talk with a Racine native who is an avid cycler and has a special place in his heart for the Tour de France. Do you follow the tour? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.